Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do four stories from Saki. First of them completes the section that we're in, and the last three are in The Square Egg, first collected in 1924. So these seem to be roughly chronological, with a few extras thrown in here and there, as we saw last session. Anyway, let's get started. First story in the last of the section, which I forget what the name of the section was, but let me see here. Let's see. Toys of Peace, yes. The last story there is For the Duration of the War, which we're going to do. Then The Square Egg is a much shorter section. Oh, I actually see that this book has some novels at the very end, more or less novella type length. So this will be the last section, including 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 stories remaining. So if we do 3 from them today, there'll be 6 left. We may just do them all in one big lump next time, but this time we'll just do 4. So the last one in The Toys of Peace and the first 3 of The Square Egg. Story is called For the Duration of the War. Asterisk. Written on the front. The Reverend Wilfred Gaspleton. He seems to like the name Wilfred. He seems to like odd last names. In one of those clerical migrations, inconsequent seeming to the lay mind, had removed from the moderately fashionable parish of St. Luke's, Kensingate, to the immoderately rural parish of St. Chuddocks, somewhere in Yondershire. There were doubtless substantial advantages connected with the move, but there were certainly some very obvious drawbacks. Neither the migratory clergyman nor his wife were able to adapt themselves naturally and comfortably to the conditions of country life. He sounded that theme more than once. Beryl. I actually knew a woman named Beryl in living in Kirksville from that old, very old generation, my grandmother's generation. But this is Beryl, the stone. Mrs. Gaspleton had always looked indulgently on the country as a place where people of irreproachable income and hospitable instincts cultivated tennis lawns and rose gardens and Jacobean plaisances, wherein selected gatherings of interested weekend guests might disport themselves. Mrs. Gaspleton considered herself as distinctly an interesting personality, and from a limited standpoint, she was doubtless right. She had indolent, dark eyes and a comfortable chin, which belied the slightly plaintive inflection which she threw into her voice at suitable intervals. She was tolerably well satisfied with the smaller advantages of life, but she regretted that fate had not seen its way to reserve for her some of the ampler successes for which she felt herself well qualified. She would have liked to be the center of a literary, slightly political salon where discerning satellites might have recognized the breadth of her outlook on human affairs and the undoubted smallness of her feet. As it was, destiny had chosen for her that she should be the wife of a rector. It had now further decreed that a country rector should be the background to her existence. She rapidly made up her mind that her surroundings did not call for exploration. Noah had predicted the flood, but no one expected him to swim about in it. Digging in a wet garden or trudging through muddy lanes were exertions which she did not propose to undertake. As long as the garden produced asparagus and carnations at pleasingly frequent intervals, Mrs. Gaspleton was content to approve of its expense and otherwise ignore its existence. She would fold herself up, so to speak, in an elegant, indolent little world of her own, enjoying the minor recreations of being gently rude to the doctor's wife and continuing the leisurely production of her one literary effort, the Forbidden Horse Pond, a translation of Baptiste Lepoy's L'Abreuvoir Interdit. It was a labor which had been already so long drawn out that it seemed probable that Baptiste Lepoy would drop out of vogue before her translation of his temporarily famous novel was finished. However, the languid prosecution of the work had invested Mrs. Gaspelton with a certain literary dignity, even in Kensingate circles, and would place her on a pinnacle in St. Chuddock's, where hardly anyone read French, and assuredly no one had heard of L'Abreuvoir Interdit. The rector's wife might be content to turn her back complacently on the country. It was the rector's tragedy that the country turned its back on him. With the best intention in the world and the immortal example of Gilbert White before him, the Reverend Wilfrid, W-I-L-F-R-I-D, found himself as bored and ill at ease in his new surroundings as Charles II would have been at a modern Wesleyan conference. Wesleyan means Methodist. The birds that hopped across his lawn hopped across it as though it were their lawn and not his, and gave him plainly to understand that in their eyes he was infinitely less interesting than a garden worm or the rectory cat. The hedgeside and meadow flowers were equally uninspiring. The lesser celandine seemed particularly unworthy of the attention that English poets had bestowed upon it. I don't know what that is, but obviously some kind of flower or plant. And the rector knew that he would be utterly miserable if left alone for a quarter of an hour in its company. Celandine, with a C. Celandine is a common plant of the buttercup family that produces yellow flowers in the early spring, reproducing either by seed or by bulbs at the bulbils at the base of the stems. I guess those are tiny bulbs. So a yellow flowering plant of the buttercup family. Let's see, where were we? With the human inhabitants of his parish, he was no better off. To know them was merely to know their ailments, and the ailments were almost invariably rheumatism. Some, of course, had other bodily infirmities, but they always had rheumatism as well. The rector had not yet grasped the fact that in rural cottage life, not to have rheumatism is as glaring an omission as not to have been presented at court would be in more ambitious circles. And with all this dearth of local interest, there was Beryl shutting herself off with her ridiculous labors on the Forbidden Horse Pond. I don't see why you should suppose that anyone wants to read Baptiste Lepoy in English, Reverend Wilfrid remarked to his wife one morning, finding her surrounded with her usual elegant litter of dictionaries, fountain pens, and scribbling paper. Hardly anyone bothers to read him now in France. My dear, said Beryl, with an intonation of gentle weariness, haven't two or three leading London publishers told me they wondered why no one had ever translated L'Abreuvoir Interdit and begged me? Publishers always clamor for the books that no one has ever written and now turn a cold shoulder on them as soon as they're written. If St. Paul were living now, they would pester him to write an epistle to the Esquimaux, but no London publisher would dream of reading his epistle to the Ephesians. Is there any asparagus anywhere in the garden? Asked Beryl, because I've told cook... Not anywhere in the garden, snapped the rector, but there's no doubt plenty in the asparagus bed, which is the usual place for it. And he walked away into the region of fruit trees and vegetable beds to exchange irritation for boredom. It was there, among the gooseberry bushes and beneath the medlar trees, that the temptation to the perpetration of a great literary fraud came to him. Some weeks later, the bi-monthly review gave to the world, under the guarantee of the Reverend Wilfrid Gaspelton. Notice that usage. You wouldn't think to write it that way. Most wouldn't, but he's saying under the name, instead of name, he says under the guarantee. So your name is your reputation, is your warranty, is your guarantee. Some weeks later, the bi-monthly review gave to the world, under the guarantee of the Reverend Wilfrid Gaspelton, some fragments of Persian verse, alleged to have been unearthed and translated by a nephew, was at present campaigning somewhere in the Tigris Valleys, or Tigris and Euphrates, the cradle of civilization, as they stage it in the school textbooks. The Reverend Wilfrid possessed a host of nephews, and it was, of course, quite possible that one or more of them might be in military employ in Mesopotamia, though no one would call to mind any particular nephew who could have been suspected of being a Persian scholar. The verses were attributed to one Ghurab, a hunter, or, according to other accounts, warden of the royal fish ponds, who lived in some unspecified century in the neighborhood of Karmanshah. They breathed a spirit of comfortable, even-tempered satire and philosophy, discussing a mockery that did not trouble to be bitter, a joy in life that was not passionate to the verge of being troublesome. And now some verses from that. A mouse that prayed for Allah's aid blasphemed when no such aid befell. A cat who feasted on that mouse thought Allah managed vastly well. Pray not for aid to one who made a set of never-changing laws, but in your need remember well he gave you speed or guile or claws. Some laud a life of mild content. Content may fall as well as pride. The frog who hugged his lowly ditch was much disgruntled when it dried. You are not on the road to hell, you tell me with fantastic glee. Vain boaster, what shall that avail if hell is on the road to thee? A poet praised the evening star. Another praised the parrot's hue. A merchant praised his merchandise. And he, at least, praised what he knew. It was this verse which gave the critics and commentators some clue as to the probable date of the composition. The parrot, they reminded the public, was in high vogue as a type of elegance in the days of Hafiz of Shiraz. In the quatrains of Omar, it makes no appearance. The next verse, it was pointed out, would apply to the political conditions of the present day as strikingly as to the region and era for which it was written. A sultan dreamed of day-long peace. A sultan dreamed day-long of peace, the while his rivals' armies grew. They changed his daydreams into sleep. The peace, methinks, he never knew. Woman appeared little, and wine not at all, in the verse of the hunter poet. But there was at least one contribution to the love philosophy of the East. O moon-faced charmer, with star-drowned eyes, and cheeks of soft delight, exhaling musk, they tell me that thy charm will fade. Ah, well, the rose itself grows hueless in the dusk. Finally, there was a recognition of the inevitable, a chill breath blowing across the poet's comfortable estimate of life. There is a sadness in each dawn, a sadness that you cannot read. R-E-D-E. The joyous day brings in its train the feast, the loved one, and the steed. Ah, there shall come a dawn at last that brings no life stir to your ken. A long, cold dawn without a day, and ye shall read its sadness then. The verses of Ghurab came on the public at a moment when a comfortable, slightly quizzical philosophy was certain to be welcome, and their reception was enthusiastic. Elderly colonels who had outlived the love of truth wrote to the papers to say that they had been familiar with the works of Ghurab in Afghanistan, and Aden, which is in Egypt, and other suitable locations a quarter of a century ago. A Ghurab of Karmanshah Club sprang into existence, the members of which alluded to each other as brother Ghurabians on the slightest provocation. And to the flood of inquiries, criticisms, and requests for information, which naturally poured in on the discoverer, or rather the discloser, of this long-hidden poet, the Reverend Wilfrid made one effectual reply. Military considerations forbade any disclosures which might throw unnecessary light on his nephew's movements. After the war, the rector's position will be one of unthinkable embarrassment, but, for the moment at any rate, he has driven the forbidden horse pond out of the field. So yet again, a man getting the better of a woman. Very common theme in Saki. Now we move on to the square egg, first collected 1924. The square egg, a badger's eye view of the war mud in the trenches. A badger's eye view of the war mud in the trenches. War mud. Mud. Assuredly, a badger is the animal that one most resembles in this trench warfare, that drab-coated creature of the twilight and darkness, digging, burrowing, listening, keeping itself as clean as possible under unfavorable circumstances, fighting tooth and nail on occasion for possession of a few yards of honeycombed earth. What the badger thinks about life, we shall never know, which is a pity, but cannot be helped. It is difficult enough to know what one thinks about oneself in the trenches. Parliament, taxes, social gatherings, economies and expenditure, and all the thousand and one horrors of civilization seem immeasurably remote, and the war itself seems almost as distant and unreal. A couple of hundred yards away, separated from you by a stretch of dismal, untidy-looking ground and some strips of rusty wire entanglement, lies a vigilant, bullet-splitting enemy. Lurking and watching in those opposing trenches are foemen who might stir the imagination of the most sluggish brain, descendants of the men who went to battle under Moltke, Blücher, Frederick the Great, and the Great Elector, Wallenstein, Morris of Saxony, Barbarossa, Albert the Bear, Henry the Lion, Wittekind the Saxon. They are matched against you there, the man for man and gun for gun, in what is perhaps the most stupendous struggle that modern history has known. And yet one thinks remarkably little about them. It would not be advisable to forget for a fraction of a second that they are there, but one's mind does not dwell on their existence. One speculates little as to whether they are drinking warm soup and eating sausage or going cold and hungry, whether they are well supplied with copies of Megendorfer Blätter and other light literature, or bored with unutterable weariness. Much more to be thought about than the enemy over yonder, or the war at all over Europe, is the mud of the moment, the mud that at times engulfs you, as cheese engulfs a cheese mite. In zoological gardens, one has gazed at an elk or bison loitering at its pleasure more than knee-deep in a quagmire of greasy mud, and one has wondered what it would feel like to be soused and plastered hour-long in the muck in such a muck bath. One knows now. In narrow dug support trenches, when thaw and heavy rain have come suddenly atop of a frost, when everything is pitch dark around you and you can only stumble about and feel your way against streaming mud walls, when you have to go down on hands and knees in several inches of excuse me. When you have to go down on hands and knees in several inches of soup-like mud to creep into a dugout, when you stand deep in mud and lean against mud, grasp mud-slimed objects with mud-caked fingers, wink mud away from your eyes and shake it out of your ears, bite muddy biscuits with muddy teeth, then at least you are in position to understand thoroughly what it feels like to wallow. On the other hand, the bison's idea of pleasure becomes more and more incomprehensible. When one is not thinking about mud, one is probably thinking about estaminets. An estaminet is a haven that one finds in agreeable plenty in most of the surrounding townships and villages, flourishing still amid roofless and deserted houses, patched up where necessary in rough and ready fashion, bombed by artillery, and finding a new and profitable tide of customers from among the soldiers who have replaced the bulk of the civil population. So this is like a pub or a beer place, beer stuba, I would guess. An estaminet is a sort of compound between a wine shop and a coffee house, having a tiny bar in one corner, a few long tables and benches, a prominent cooking stove, generally a small grocery store tucked away in the back premises, and always two or three children running and bumping about at inconvenient angles to one's feet. It seems to be a fixed rule that estaminet children should be big enough to run about and small enough to get between one's legs. There must, by the way, be one considerable advantage in being a child in a war zone village. No one can attempt to teach it tidiness. The wearisome maxim, a place for everything and everything in its place, can never be insisted on when a considerable part of the roof is lying in the backyard, when a bedspread from a neighbor's demolished bedroom is half buried in the beetroot pile, and the chickens are roosting in a derelict meat safe because a shell has removed the top and sides and front of the chicken house. Perhaps there is nothing in the foregoing description to suggest that a village wine shop, frequently by a shell-nibbled building in a shell-gnawed street, is a paradise to dream about. But when one has lived in the dripping wilderness of unrelieved mud and sodden sandbags for any length of time, one's mind dwells on the plain-furnished parlor with its hot coffee and vin ordinaire as something warm and snug and comforting in a wet and slushy world. To the soldier on his trench to billets, migration, the wine shop. No, I misread that. Okay. To the soldier on his trench to billets migration, the wine shop is what the tavern rest house is to the caravan nomad of the East. One comes and goes in a crowd of chance foregathered men, noticed or unnoticed as one wishes, amid the khaki clad, beputtied throng of one's own kind. One can be as unobtrusive as a green caterpillar on a green cabbage leaf. One can sit undisturbed, alone or with one's own friends, or if one wishes to be talkative and talk to, one can readily find a place in a circle of men of diverse variety of cap badges or exchanging experiences, real or improvised. That's his cleverness for lying. Worthy of Twain, I should say. Twain may have even used it in that way, although I don't recall that he did. Besides the changing throng of mud-stained khaki, there is a drifting leaven of local civilians, uninformed interpreters, and men in varying types of foreign military garb, from privates in the regular army to heaven knows what in some intermediate corps that only an expert in such matters could put a name to. And, of course, here and there are representatives of that great army of adventurer purse-sappers that carries on its operations uninterruptedly in time of peace and war alike, thieves, over the greater part of the earth's surface. You meet them in England, in France, in Russia, in Constantinople. Probably they are to be met with also in Iceland, although on that point I have no direct evidence. In the establishment of the Fortunate Rabbit, capital FR, I found myself sitting next to an individual of indefinite age and nondescript uniform who was obviously determined to make the borrowing of a match serve as a formal introduction and a banker's reference. He had the air of jaded jauntiness, the equipment of temporary amiability, the aspect of a foraging crow, knows the aspect for a face and attitude you hold it, taught by experience to be wary and prompted by necessity to be bold. He had the contemplative downward droop of nose and mustache and the furtive sidelong range of eye. He had all those things that are the ordinary outfit of a purse-sapper the world over. Not necessarily a thief, but a borrower. The type of person that we've seen on benches and parks in other stories. A purse-sapper, he calls him here. "I am a victim of the war," he exclaimed after a little preliminary conversation. "One cannot make an omelet without breaking eggs," I answered, with the appropriate callousness of a man who had seen some dozens of square miles of devastated countryside and roofless houses. "Eggs," he vociferated, "but it is precisely of eggs that I am about to speak. Have you ever considered what is the great drawback in the excellent and most useful egg, the ordinary everyday egg of commerce and cookery? Its tendency to age rapidly is sometimes against it," I hazarded. "Unlike the United States of North America, which grow more respectable and self-respecting the longer they last, an egg gains nothing by persistence. It resembles your Louis XV, who declined in popular favor with every year he lived, unless the historians have entirely misrepresented his record." "No," replied the tavern acquaintance, capital TA, "seriously, it is not a question of age. It is the shape, the roundness. Consider how easily it rolls. On a table, a shelf, a shop counter, perhaps one little push, and it may roll to the floor and be destroyed. What a catastrophe for the poor, the frugal." I gave a sympathetic shudder at the idea. "Eggs here cost 6 sous apiece." "Monsieur," he continued, "it is a subject I had often pondered and turned over in my mind, this economical malformation of the household egg. In our little village of Virchy-les-Torteaux, in the department of the Tarn, my aunt has a small dairy and poultry farm from which we drew a modest income. We were not poor, but there was always the necessity to labor, to contrive, to be sparing. One day I chanced to notice that one of my aunt's hens, a hen of the mop-headed Houdan breed, had laid an egg that was not altogether so round-shaped as the eggs of other hens. It could not be called square, but it had well-defined angles. I found out that this particular bird always laid eggs of this particular shape. The discovery gave a new stimulus to my ideas. If one collected all the hens that one could find with a tendency to lay slightly angular eggs and bred chickens only from those hens, and went on selecting and selecting, always choosing those that laid the squarest egg, at last, with patience and enterprise, one would produce a breed of fowls that laid only square eggs. In the course of several hundred years, one might arrive at such a result, I said. It would probably, more probably, take several thousands. With your cold, northern, conservative, slow-moving hens, that might be the case, said the acquaintance impatiently and rather angrily. With our vivacious southern poultry, it is different. Listen. I searched. I experimented. I explored the poultry yards of our neighbors. I ransacked the markets of the surrounding towns. Whenever I found a hen laying an angular egg, I brought her. I bought her. I collected in time a vast concourse of fowls, all sharing the same tendency. From their progeny, I selected only those pullets whose eggs showed the most marked deviation from the normal roundness. I continued. I persevered. Monsieur, I produced a breed of hens that laid an egg which could not roll, however much you might push or prod it, push or jostle it. My experiment was more than a success. It was one of the romances of modern industry. Of that I had not the least doubt, but I did not say so. Romance meaning a made-up, concocted sty. I used to know this woman who believed that, I think I called something, she said a story, and she got really angry because she was older, and to her story was the same as lie. And this might be in the same way, romance meaning a lie to him. My eggs became known, continued the soi-disant poultry farmer, the self-described or self-calling. At first they were sought after as a novelty, something curious, bizarre. Then merchants and housewives began to see that they were a utility, an improvement, an advantage over the ordinary kind. I was able to command a sale for my wares at a price considerably above market rates. I began to make money. I had a monopoly. I refused to sell any of my square layers, and the eggs that went to market were carefully sterilized so that no chickens should be hatched from them. I was in the way to become rich, comfortably rich. Then this war broke out, which has brought misery to so many. I was obliged to leave my hens and my customers and go to the front. My aunt carried on the business as usual, sold the square eggs, the eggs that I had devised and created and perfected, and received the profits. Can you imagine it? She refuses to send me one centime of the takings. She says that she looks after the hens and pays for their corn and sends the eggs to market and that the money is hers. Legally, of course, it is all mine, or it is mine. If I could afford to bring a process in the courts, I could recover all the money that the eggs have brought in since the war commenced, many thousands of francs. To bring a process, I would only need a small sum. I have a lawyer friend who would arrange matters cheaply for me. Unfortunately, I have not sufficient funds in hand. I still need about 80 francs. In wartime, alas, it is difficult to borrow. I had always imagined that it was a habit that was especially indulged in during wartime and said so. On a big scale, yes. See, again, that's why the Jews took over set up the central bank. The banking can be used not just to destroy the currency and steal the money, but it can be used to inflate the money to pay for foreign wars that you want, like World War I and World War II and basically all the wars. And he's kind of making it, that's what he's making an allusion to, not Jews, but the fact that war brings debt and poverty. And I had always imagined that it was a habit that was especially indulged in during wartime, going into debt. The kings would have to raise money from the Jews to field an army, and said so. On a big scale, yes, but I am talking of a very small matter. It is easier to arrange a loan of millions than a trifle of 80 or 90 francs. The would-be financier paused for a few tense moments. Then he recommenced in a more confidential strain. Some of you English soldiers, I have heard, are men with private means. Is it not so? Is it possible that among your comrades there might be someone willing to advance a small sum, you yourself, perhaps? It would be secure and profitable investment, quickly repaid. If I get a few days' leave, I will go down to Verchères-lès-Tourteaux and inspect the Square Egg hen farm, I said gravely, and question the local egg merchants as to the position and prospects of the business. The tavern acquaintance gave an almost imperceptible shrug to his shoulders, shifted in his seat, and began moodily to roll a cigarette. His interest in me had suddenly died out, but for the sake of appearances, he was bound to make a perfunctory show of winding up the conversation he had so laboriously started. "Ah, you will go to Verchères-lès-Tourteaux and make inquiries about our farm. And if you find that what I have told you about the square eggs is true, monsieur, what then?" "I shall marry your aunt." That's funny. That's a good one. And so let's see. Was that the very first story? Yeah, that was the first in the square egg. Naturally, since it was about square eggs. So we'll do two more. The next one is Birds on the Western Front. Considering the enormous economic dislocation which the war operations have caused in the regions where the campaign is raging, there seems to be very little corresponding disturbance in the bird life of the same districts. Rats and mice have mobilized and swarmed into the fighting line, and there has been a partial mobilization of owls, particularly barn owls, following in the wake of the mice and making laudable efforts to thin out their numbers. What success attends their hunting, one cannot estimate. There are always sufficient mice left over to populate one's dugout and make a parade ground and race course of one's face at night. Can you even imagine that? How miserable that would be? In a nasty, horrible, muddy trench, and then you got mice running all over your face? Jesus. In the matter of nesting accommodation, the barn owls are well provided for. Most of the still intact barns in the war zone are requisitioned for billeting purposes, but there is a wealth of ruined houses, whole streets and clusters of them, such as can hardly have been available at any previous moment of the world's history, since Nineveh and Babylon became humanly desolate. Without human occupation and cultivation, there can have been no corn, no refuse, and consequently very few mice, and the owls of Nineveh cannot have enjoyed very good hunting. Here in northern France, the owls of desolation, and mice at their disposal in unlimited quantities. And as these birds breed in winter as well as in summer, there should be a goodly output of war owlets to cope with the swarming generations of war mice. Apart from the owls, one cannot notice that the campaign is making any marked difference in the bird life of the countryside. The vast flocks of crows and ravens that one expected to find in the neighborhood of the fighting line are non-existent, which is perhaps rather a pity. The obvious explanation is that the roar and crash and fumes of high explosives have driven the crow tribe in panic from the fighting area. Like many obvious explanations, it is not a correct one. The crows of the locality are not attracted to the battlefield, but they certainly are not scared away from it. The rook is normally so gun-shy and nervous where noise is concerned that the sharp bang of a barn door or the report of a toy pistol will sometimes set an entire rookery in commotion. Out here, I have seen him sedately busy among the refuse heaps of a battered village with shells bursting at no great distance and the impatient-sounding, snapping rattle of machine guns going on all round him. For all the notice that he took, he might as well have been in some peaceful English meadow on a sleepy Sunday afternoon. Whatever else German frightfulness may have done, it has not frightened the rook of northeastern France. It has made his nerves steadier than they ever were before, and future generations of small boys, employed in scaring rooks away from the sown crops in this region, will have to invent something in the way of super frightfulness to achieve their purpose. Crows and magpies are nesting well within the shell-swept area, and over a small beech copse I once saw a pair of crows engaged in hot combat with a pair of sparrowhawks, While considerably higher in the sky, but almost directly above them, two Allied battle planes were engaging an equal number of enemy aircraft. Unlike the barn owls, the magpies have had their choice of building sites considerably restricted by the ravages of war. The whole avenues of poplars where they were accustomed to construct their nests have been blown to bits, the poplars, leaving nothing but dreary-looking rows of shattered and splintered trunks to show where once they stood. Affection for a particular tree has in one case induced a pair of magpies to build their bulky domed nest in the battered remnants of a poplar, of which so little remained standing that the nest looked almost bigger than the tree. The effect rather suggested an archiepiscopal enthronement taking place in the ruined remains of Melrose Abbey. The magpie, wary and suspicious in his wild state, must be rather intrigued at the change that has come over the erstwhile fearsome, not to be avoided human, stalking everywhere over the earth as its possessor, who now creeps about in screened and sheltered ways as chary of showing himself in the open, as the shyest of wild creatures. The buzzard, that earnest seeker after mice, does not seem to be taking any war risks, at least I have never seen one out here, but kestrels hover about all day in the hottest parts of the line, not in the least disconcerted, apparently, when a promising mouse area suddenly rises in the air in a cascade of black or yellow earth. Sparrowhawks are fairly numerous, and a mile or two back from the firing line, I saw a pair of hawks that I took to be red-legged falcons circling over the top of an oak copse. According to investigations made by Russian naturalists, the effect of the war on bird life on the Eastern Front has been more marked than it has been over here. Quote, during the first year of the war, rooks disappeared. Larks no longer sang in the fields. The wild pigeon disappeared also. The skylark in this region has stuck tenaciously to the meadows and croplands that have been seamed and bisected with trenches and honeycombed with shell holes. In the chill, misty hour of gloom that precedes a rainy dawn, when nothing seemed alive except a few wary waterlogged sentries and many scuttling rats, the lark would suddenly dash forward, dash skyward, and pour forth a song of ecstatic jubilation. It sounded horribly forced and insincere. It seemed scarcely possible that the bird could carry its insouciance to the length of attempting to rear a brood in that desolate wreckage of shattered clods and gaping shell holes, but once, having occasion to throw myself down with some abruptness on my face, I found myself nearly on top of a brood of young larks. Two of them had already been hit by something and were in a rather battered condition, but the survivor seemed as tranquil and comfortable as the average nestling. At the corner of a stricken wood, which has a name made for it in history, but I should know it, but I don't, but shall be nameless here. At a moment when lyddite and shrapnel and machine gun fire swept and raked and bespattered that devoted spot as though billow woods, as though the artillery of an entire division had suddenly concentrated on it, a wee henchafinch flitted wistfully to and fro amid splintered and falling branches that had never a green bough left on them. The wounded lying there, if any of them noticed the small bird, may well have wondered why anything having wings and no pressing reason for remaining should have chosen to stay in such a place. There was a battered orchard alongside the stricken wood, and the probable explanation of the bird's presence was that it had a nest of young ones whom it was too scared to feed, too loyal to desert. Later on, a small flock of chaffinches blundered into the wood, which they were doubtless in the habit of using as a highway to their feeding grounds. Unlike the solitary hen bird, they made no secret of their desire to get his way as fast as their dazed wits would carry them. The only other bird I ever saw there was a magpie flying low over the wreckage of fallen tree limbs. One for sorrow, says the old superstition. There was sorrow enough in that wood. The English gamekeeper, whose knowledge of wildlife usually runs on limited and perverted lines, I really wonder what that means, has evolved a sort of religion as to the nervous debility of even the hardiest game birds. According to his beliefs, a terrier trotting across a field in which a partridge is nesting, or a mouse-hawking kestrel hovering over the edge is sufficient to drive the distracted bird off its eggs and send it whirring into the next county. The partridge in the war zone shows no signs of such sensitive nerves. The rattle and rumble of transport, the constant coming and going of bodies of troops, the incessant rattle of musketry and deafening explosions of artillery, the night-long flare and flicker of star shells, have not sufficed to scare the local birds away from their chosen feeding grounds, and to all appearances they have not been deterred from raising their broods. Gamekeepers who are serving with the colors might seize the opportunity to indulge in a little useful nature study. The last story is the Gala Program, an unrecorded episode in Roman history. The Gala Program, an unrecorded episode in Roman history. The Gala Program. It was an auspicious day in the Roman calendar, the birthday of the popular and gifted young Emperor Placidus Superbus. Everyone in Rome was bent on keeping high festival. The weather was at its best, and naturally the imperial circus was crowded to its fullest capacity. A few minutes before the hour fixed for the commencement of the spectacle, a loud fanfare of trumpets proclaimed the arrival of Caesar, and amid the vociferous acclamations of the multitude, the emperor took his seat in the imperial box. As the shouting of the crowd died away, an even more thrilling salutation could be heard in the near distance, the angry, impatient roaring and howling of the beasts caged in the imperial menagerie. "Explain the program to me," commanded the emperor, having beckoned the master of ceremonies to his side. That eminent official wore a troubled look. "Gracious Caesar," he announced, "a most promising and entertaining program has been devised and prepared for your august approval. In the first place, there is to be a chariot contest of unusual brilliancy and interest. Three teams that have never hitherto suffered defeat are to contend for the Herculaneum trophy, together with a purse which your imperial generosity has been pleased to add. The chances of the competing teams are accounted to be as nearly as possible equal, and there is much wagering among the populace. The Black Thracians are perhaps the favorites." I know, interrupted the Caesar, who had listened to the exhaustive talk on the same subject all the morning. "What else is there on the program?" "The second part of the program," said the imperial official, "consists of a grand combat of wild beasts, specially selected for their strength, ferocity, and fighting qualities. There will appear simultaneously in the arena 14 Nubian lions and lionesses, 5 tigers, 6 Syrian bears, 8 Persian panthers, and 3 North African ditto, a number of wolves and lynxes from the Teutonic forests, and 7 gigantic wild bulls from the same region. There will also be wild swine of unexampled savageness, rhinoceros from the Barbary coast, some ferocious man-apes, a hyena, reputed to be mad," so animals from all around the Roman world, around the Mediterranean, from Germany down to Libya, or Carthage or North Africa. "It promises well," said the emperor. "It promised well, O Caesar," said the official dolorously, painfully. "It promised marvelously well, but between the promise and the performance, a cloud has arisen." "A cloud? What cloud?" queried Caesar with a frown. "The suffragettae," that is, Roman suffragettes, explained the official. "They threaten to interfere with the chariot race." "I'd like to see them do it," exclaimed the emperor indignantly. "I fear your imperial wish may be unpleasantly gratified," said the master of the ceremonies. "We are taking, of course, every possible precaution and guarding all the entrances to the arena and the stables with a triple guard, but it is rumored that at the signal for the entry of the chariots, 500 women will let themselves down with ropes from the public seats and swarm all over the course. Naturally, no race could be run under such circumstances. The program will be ruined. On my birthday, said Placidus Superbus, they would not dare to do such an outrageous thing. The more august the occasion, the more desirous they will be to advertise themselves and their cause, said the harassed official. They do not scruple to make riotous interference even with the ceremonies in the temples. Who are these suffragettae? Asked the emperor. So that's a Latin plural. He's being funny. Since I came back from my Pannonian expedition, I have heard of nothing else but their excesses and demonstrations. They are a political sect of very recent origin, and their aim seems to be to get a big share of political authority into their hands. The means they are taking to convince us of their fitness to help in making and administering the laws consist of wild indulgences in tumult, destruction, and defiance of all authority. They have already damaged some of the most historically valuable of our public treasures, which can never be replaced. Is it possible that the sects which we hold in such honor, and for which we feel such admiration, can produce such hordes of furies? Asked the emperor. It takes all sorts to make a sex. Notice sex, not gender, correct. There was someone who literally did not believe me when I said that sex was the word that was used up until about 1980. And even the ones who didn't use it knew that they were misusing gender, which refers only to grammar properly. It takes all sorts to make a sex, observed the master of ceremonies, who possessed a certain amount of worldly wisdom. Also, he continued anxiously, it takes very little to upset a gala program. Perhaps the disturbance that you anticipate will turn out to be an idle threat, said the emperor consolingly. But if they should carry out their intention, said the official, the program will be utterly ruined. The emperor said nothing, and we're reminded of an earlier story. You can't remember the names of any of the stories, at least I can't. I can remember what happened in many of them, but you take it as one body of work, he certainly has certain themes he keeps going back to. He probably has 5 or 6 themes he goes back to all the time, sometimes multiple in the same story. 5 minutes later, the trumpets rang out for the commencement of the entertainment. A hum of excited anticipation ran through the ranks of the spectators, and final bets on the issue of the great race were hurriedly shouted. The gates leading from the stables were slowly swung open, and a troop of mounted attendants rode around the track to ascertain that everything was clear for the momentous contest. Again the trumpets rang out, and then, before the foremost chariot had appeared, there arose a wild tumult of shouting, laughing, angry protests, and shrill screams of defiance. Hundreds of women were being lowered by their accomplices into the arena. A moment later, they were running and dancing in frenzied troops across the track where the chariots were supposed to compete. No team of arena-trained horses would have faced such a frantic mob. The race was clearly an impossibility. Howls of disappointment and rage rose from the spectators. Howls of triumph echoed back from the women in possession. The vain efforts of the circus attendants to drive out the invading. I know what he's going to do. He's going to say, let's just reverse the program, do Act 2 first. Right? And then have the race after the animals eat all the women. The vain efforts of the circus attendants to drive out the invading horde merely added to the uproar and confusion. As fast as the suffragettae were thrust away from one portion of the track, they swarmed onto another. The master of ceremonies was nearly delirious from rage and mortification. Placidus Superbus, who remained calm and unruffled as ever, beckoned to him and spoke a word or two in his ear. For the first time that afternoon, the sorely tried official was seen to smile. A trumpet rang from the imperial box. An instant hush fell over the excited throng. Perhaps the emperor, as a last resort, was going to announce some concession to the suffragettae. Close the stable gates, commanded the master of ceremonies, and open the menagerie dens. It is the imperial pleasure that the second portion of the program be taken first. Ah, that's funny. It turned out that the master of ceremonies had in no wise exaggerated the probable brilliancy of this portion of the spectacle. The wild bulls were really wild, and the hyena, reputed to be mad, thoroughly lived up to its reputation. So you see, really, whatever changes. I mean, people today, if you said, yeah, let's throw the feminists in the ring and have wild animals, tear them to bits and eat them, the vast majority of people would just love that. Suffragettes caused the same problems 100 years ago or even 2,000 years ago they caused today. What a beautiful story and a beautiful way to end this session. Thanks for being with me. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of the complete stories of Saki, who is, on his birth certificate, Hector Hugh Munroe, M-U-N-R-O. And as always, it's recorded for the benefit of all posterity at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon for more wonderful stuff from Saki.